section of the discussion, and this relates to Beis Din procedural rules. So we're going to have a number of chaburos that will be devoted to different procedural rules of Beis Din and arbitration practice, and how in practicality it plays out when there are various requirements of the halacha and requirements of secular law that might intersect or that might actually conflict with each other, and how that actually plays out. So the first of this series is with respect to attorneys. And we have a number of different questions that we have posed that we will try to address in reviewing the sources and speaking about some of the cases that actually arise. The first question is there a right of counsel according to halakha for a Beit Din proceeding? Right, under Article 6 of the Illinois Arbitration Statute, whenever you have an arbitration in front of an arbitration tribunal, every single party has a right to be represented by an attorney. And if you deny a party the right to be represented by an attorney, that could be grounds for overturning the decision of the arbitration panel. So is there such an obligation from the standpoint of halakha? That there should be a right of counsel. And that, of course, leads into question two. What if secular law requires a right to counsel, as in the Illinois arbitration statute? Does this impact upon the halakha? If the halakha would not otherwise impose the right of a party to be represented by an attorney, do we say that if the arbitration law says that this is something that any arbitration tribunal has to allow for and accommodate, so does that actually have an impact on what the halakha will demand in order to ensure the enforceability of the Beis Din proceeding? Number three, is there a distinction between the right to an attorney, right? Because the statute, the Illinois statute, and most arbitration statutes, which are modeled after the uniform arbitration statute and so forth, say that there is a right to an attorney. But is there a distinction between that and the right to a rabbinic advocate? So your party, you know, comes in and says they want a rabbinic advocate, and the statute says that they have a right to an attorney. Does one translate into the other? And is there room to distinguish between allowing one and allowing the other? Number four, is it permissible if we come to the conclusion that halakha doesn't automatically allow for a right of counsel? So what about the counsel himself or herself? Is it permissible to serve as an attorney? Or for that matter, let's say that we come to the conclusion that it's dubious if there's a right to serve, if there's a right of a party to be represented by a Tohen Rabbani, by a rabbinic advocate. So let's turn it around to the other side. The person who actually functions professionally as an attorney or a rabbinic advocate, is it permissible for them to serve in that capacity in front of a Beit Din? Does the halakha actually permit serving in that type of a role? And number five, are there any rules of ethical conduct that must be followed by rabbinic advocates? We know that lawyers have professional rules of legal conduct that they are supposed to follow, which if they don't follow, they can be subject to disciplinary action. Do the same rules or similar rules apply to rabbinic advocates to the extent that we do allow a countenance presence of rabbinic advocates in Beis Din proceedings? Now, one could certainly also have a discussion regarding the propriety of serving as an attorney altogether. Imagine some of those around the table have law degrees, like myself, and some even continue to serve in the capacity as being an attorney. Not like myself. I gave that up. I retired a long time ago from, you know, my legal practice. But we're not going to focus per se, since the emphasis of these chaburos is upon the Beis Din cases and, you know, the Dayan's desk cases that come in front of the Beis Din. We're going to focus primarily upon the role of attorneys or Tohanim Rabbanim in the context of Beis Din proceedings. If anybody has related questions that are impact upon, you know, serving as an attorney in general, so obviously we can touch upon that, but, you know, that's not going to be, you know, the major focus. Yes.
They have Kohanot in Israeli court. How does that differ?
In Israeli Bati Din, they have not only Tohanim, rabbinic advocates, but they have Tohanot.
That's what I said.
Female.
No. Right, they have female advocates.
That's right. The first one was Haim Fine's daughter, you may remember.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. Yes, well, there are...
So it's a rabbinic advocate, is it Tohen or a Tohanot? Tohenet.
Right, so when people would ask me the question, does halacha permit Tohenot? I would ask, before you ask me whether halacha permits Tohenot, ask me whether halacha permits Tohenim.
Right.
Because first we have to examine that issue, and that will have an impact upon Tohenot. But if Tohenim are permitted, then Tohenot would also be permitted. No reason why a female couldn't serve in that role as well, in my humble opinion. But we have to figure out to what extent either role would be endorsed according to halacha. The halacha also does not distinguish between male attorneys and female attorneys, for that matter. Wouldn't distinguish between Tohanim and Tohanot. Okay, so let's start off with the obvious starting points. The Mishnah Maseches Avos, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Ches, Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach were among the Zugos, right? The one was the Nasi, one was the Abezdin. And Yehuda ben Tabai said, Omer al tas atzucha ko'oche yadayonim. Don't act like a lawyer. Don't act like a lawyer. Sounds like you're not really supposed to be a lawyer. Now, we're talking in the context of Bezdin proceedings, of what is permitted and what is frowned upon in the context of Bezdin proceedings. And Yehuda ben Tabai says, don't be a lawyer. Now, he goes on to talk about that when the litigants are in front of the Bezdin should view them as wicked. When the case is over, the Bezdin should view them, the litigants, as Zakayin, as meritorious, provided, of course, that they have accepted the judgment of the Bezdin. If they leave the judgment and say, they leave the Bezdin and say, we have no intention of complying with the judgment, so then the Bezdin does not have to view them as Zakayin, as righteous or meritorious in any way. However, the question is, do we somehow make a comparison between the first part of the Mishnah and the second part of the Mishnah to say it's just like the second part of the Mishnah is addressing itself to Dayanim, talking about the perspective and outlook of the Dayanim, so to the first part of the Mishnah maybe is also referring to Dayanim and saying that Dayanim are not supposed to conduct themselves as attorneys, but of course it's to be expected that attorneys who are representing clients in front of the Bezdin could by all means conduct themselves as attorneys. That's why they're attorneys. They're supposed to act like attorneys.
But it's clear so, there are attorneys.
It's clear that there is such a thing as attorneys. It doesn't mean that this is a practice that Chazal viewed with favor. So we'll see. So Rashi, in his Perush and Pirkei Avos, gives really three different interpretations of what Orchei Dayanim, or at least what this injunction against Orchei Dayanim is referring to. The first is that it's referring to a dayan itself. It's saying that just like the Orchei Dayanim tell people what to say and what to do. So Yehuda ben Tabai is saying that the dayan should not conduct himself in that fashion. The dayan should not tell one party, oh, I think you have a better case and you're going to win this case. Or direct the parties or show their hand or tilt the balance in any way, that the dayanim are not supposed to conduct themselves like attorneys. Second explanation of Rashi in the name of Rabbi Yehudai Gaon is that a dayan is not, even if a dayan has not been appointed to a particular case, let's say that somebody calls up a dayan because they have a pending litigation. They don't know exactly where it's going to be adjudicated. Maybe this in front of the dayan's bezdin, maybe in front of a different bezdin. But they figure, I'll call up my friend, the local dayan, and I'll ask the dayan, what do you think are my chances of winning this case? Do you think that I have a good claim, or do I think that I have a winning claim, or that I don't have a winning claim against my friend? This is my simple call. Yo, people do this all the time. And Rashi says that the Mishnah is really saying a dayan is supposed to stay away from having that type of conversation because that could also be improper involvement in a case that might, for all we know, eventually come in front of that dayan. So I have to be very careful when I get phone calls of that sort to say, okay, you have a case. You could bring it to the bez that I could tell you procedurally what you're supposed to do, but substantively I can't discuss the case with you. And then the third explanation that Rashi has is that, in fact, nobody should act like a dual lawyer. That if somebody is going to consult with you because you're a big Talmid Chacham, what type of claims should be argued in court because they have a court case against their fellow, so then you're not supposed to counsel somebody in a way in which you're going to enable them to gain an advantage over the other side. So Rashi therefore presents really from the first explanation to the third explanation both possibilities. Number one, that a dayan is not supposed to advocate on behalf of either side to kind of steer that side in a particular direction to help the side with their arguments in front of the Bezdin or give them advice about how good their case is. And the third explanation of Rashi also is along the lines of what is prohibited for somebody who is a non-dayan, where Rashi says that even for a non-dayan, it's improper to get involved in a case which is not the specific matter that pertains to that individual. You shouldn't interfere in somebody else's business. And if you look in sources 3 and 4, you find also these different interpretations from other Meforshei Mishnah. The Bar Tanura seems to understand that it's talking about don't be kosen anashim she'ochim misadim tainos baledin lefnei adayonim. Don't be like a sort of a person who advises somebody what to do in order to win the case. That sounds like it's an admonition against really acting as a lawyer. And the Rambam says that it's an admonition to the Dayanim, that the Dayanim should not act as lawyers in terms of advising the litigants as they are presenting their cases in front of the Beis Din. So appears to be at least a possible interpretation from the Mishnah that is recognized as one of the aspects of what the Mishnah is prohibiting regarding serving as an actual advocate to a party in the context of a Beis Din proceeding. Now, it's important to recognize that when Chazal talk about serving Ke'orchei HaDayonim, they could be talking about one of two different possible roles. One role would be as a lawyer who is essentially a transactional attorney who is advising a party regarding how they should go about a particular dispute that they have with another individual prior to litigation, where they are knowledgeable about the law. Somebody comes to them and says, how can I harness the law to my advantage? And they just tell them, this is how you can harness the law to your advantage in order to win a dispute that or overcome a problem that you have with another individual. That's one type of lawyerly role. And a second lawyerly role, of course, is representing a party and arguing a case in front of the court. That is serving as a litigator. It's important to isolate these two different roles because they're subject to two different discussions in the rabbinic literature. When we say al tas atzmecho ko'orchei hadayanim, we're not necessarily referring to one as opposed to the other role. It all depends upon the context. In the context of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, it was generally understood as referring to, you know, somebody who is advising somebody about what they should argue in front of the Beis Din, but not necessarily somebody who is standing in front of the Beis Din and serving as the litigator who is presenting that party's case in front of the Beis Din. So if you look in the Gemara, you'll see that the Gemara brings this idea or brings this prohibition against serving Ke'orchei HaDayanim in the context of a legal advisor as opposed to a litigant who is actually arguing a case in court. So they're really subject to two different discussions. So we'll focus on the legal advisor discussion first. The Gemara in Ksuvos in Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis, this is source A, talks about a relative of Rabbi Yochanan who had a father who entered into a second marriage. The Gemara seems to recognize that many disputes come out of second marriages, especially with respect to the children from the first marriage who aren't always so happy about the effects of a second marriage. And the case over here was a case where apparently the child saw that the father was spending a lot of the father had a second wife, and the father passed away. But the assets of the estate were dedicated to the widow because the ksuva is, you know, set aside for the widow. But before the widow could collect the entire ksuva, she's entitled to receive money from the estate in order to pay for her refuah, to pay for her medical needs. And her medical needs were very, very substantial. And she needed medical help every single day, and that was depleting the assets of the estate. So this person came in front of Rabbi Yochanan and said, What should I do? That the widow is depleting the assets of the estate. And Rabbi Yochanan said, "Izidu kotsu le midi the rofe." So Rabbi Yochanan said that there is a principle in halakha that if it's a refua sheyesh lo kitzva, if there's a doctor, there were doctors even today who specialize in, you know, like figuring out what's the value for litigation purposes of a medical claim. So if you go to a doctor who's able to assess, well, this is the amount of money that should be set aside for this particular medical treatment, and it is quantified. Once it is quantified, so then the widow wouldn't be allowed to receive more than the quantified amount. She wouldn't be able to keep on depleting the estate day in and day out until it might exceed, you know, all of the assets of the estate. But rather, she would have to only exhaust the assets up until the actual quantified amount that was stipulated by the medical experts. So after Rabbi Yochanan rendered this advice, he said, I shouldn't have done that. He gave himself a slap on the face, said, I shouldn't have done that. What was I thinking? Because I have given advice to somebody in order to enable them to gain an advantage over, you know, this situation, over the widow who was taking from the estate, and I really shouldn't have done that. So may he cover myself, or let me soap myself. So why then did he do it in the first place? If it was something which was a violation of this Mishnah, that you're not supposed to make yourself keokei adayonim, you're not supposed to give legal advice to help somebody in their own private dispute. So says the Gemara, may he cover sovim misarchol atisalim. Originally he thought he's doing a mitzvah because he's a relative and there's a mitzvah to help a relative. The mashmalz is, if somebody is serving in this type of legal advisory role and they're not a relative, then they certainly should not even think about getting involved in this sort of thing. But even as a relative, in the end, he realized he shouldn't do it. L'besof sava adam chashuv shiny, since he was an adam chashuv, he was a rabbinic role model. Rabbinic role models have to hold themselves to a different standard, a higher standard, because people look at their conduct and they learn from them, and people who might not even be relatives of somebody might say, oh, Rabbi Yochanan did it, so therefore I could do it too. So Rabbi Yochanan realized that he had to hold himself to a stricter standard because he was a rabbinic role model. Similarly, the Gemara in Ksubas and Daf Pei Hei Amud Beis talks about a relative of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman had a relative who she was a woman, and she sold the future value of her ksuba, betovas hana. In other words, let's say the ksuba would be worth $10,000, so maybe she might sell it for $3,000 based on present value of the money and also the actuarial chances that she's actually going to receive the ksuba, because she only receives the ksuba in the event that she gets divorced or if the husband dies. But if she predeceases the husband, then she doesn't get the ksuba. So she sold the ksuba betovas hana, which is certainly at a discount, and then the husband divorced her. So then she was entitled to the money, but then the money would go to the purchaser. So let's say the $10,000 that the ksuba was worth would have gone to the purchaser, but she ushkiva, she died before she was able to collect the amount. So then the amount was going to go to the daughter. The husband would no longer inherit her because he divorced her. Apparently they had one only child who was a daughter, that's the relative of Rav Nachman, and they went to the daughter and said, you're going to get the money from the ksuba, from the father, and therefore, since there was a deal made that it was sold by the mother, it would have to go to the purchaser. So the daughter didn't want to lose the amount of the ksuva. So Rav Nachman came up with really a brilliant idea. He said, there's a halacha that if somebody sells a shtar chov, they sell a promissory note that somebody else owes to them, then even after you sell the note, the debt, that someone, the promissory note that somebody else owes to you, you have the right to forgive it after you have sold it. That if you sell your shtar chov to somebody else and then you sell it, so then you forgive it, it's still considered to be forgiven. It's an amazing halacha.
You have to repurchase?
You can, it no longer belongs to you. You sold it to somebody else, but because of the right fact that you have, the way Rabbeinu Tam explains, there's a shibud aguf, that there is an obligation, a personal obligation that's owed to the person who is the original creditor. That personal obligation cannot be sold. the shibuna and the chasim can be sold, the right to the money can be sold, but the actual personal obligation still attaches to the original creditor. The original creditor, therefore, can always forgive that personal obligation. Once he forgives the personal obligation, the monetary obligation goes away as well. So Rav Nachman advised the daughter to forgive the debt, and therefore the ksuva would no longer be owing from the father. Once the ksuva would no longer be owing from the father, eventually the father would die. When the father would die, who would inherit the father? The daughter would inherit the father, including the amount of the ksuva that she had forgiven. So therefore, she would end up being able to recover the ksuva in this way by forgiving the debt. So this was really a brilliant idea. Even though, by the way, there is a halacha that if somebody forgives a debt that they sold to somebody else, they do bear a certain amount of financial liability to the purchaser, because it's called garmi, it's called a direct type of damage that's being caused by this act of forgiving the debt. So the Mefarshim explained, but in this case the daughter wouldn't have been obligated because she was a katana, or because she was married and she didn't have any assets, or arguably, even if she would have an obligation to pay, she would only have to pay the amount that the purchaser had actually paid for the ksuva. Let's say the $2,000, but she wouldn't have to pay the $10,000, so she would still get a windfall. So in the end, Rav Nachman slapped himself on the face and he said, "Ach, what did I do? Asino atzmenu ke'ochei adoyon." So the Gemara asked me, "Kara my sover, the besof my sover." So why did he originally do it in the first place? The same exact shakla v'tarya of the Gemara, "Me kara sover misachol tisalim." And originally he thought he was doing a mitzvah, "Well, the besof sover adam chashiv shiny." But then in the end, he came to the conclusion that adam chashiv, since he's such an important rabbinic role model, it's not seemly for him to get involved in this type of legal advice. So the Piskei Tshuva, source 7, brings this to halacha. He brings it in a halachic realm. He says that this is not only just a kind of an esoteric discussion. This has real halachic ramifications. And he says that really a person should not serve in this capacity as a legal advisor in the manner of Rabbi Yochanan or Rav Nachman, if they're an Adam Chashuv, right? And let's say they're not an Adam Chashuv, so then the clear implication of the Gemara is, well, if they're a relative, then it's appropriate to do because of the mitzvah of a Misachol Lo Tisalim. But let's say they're neither an Adam Chashuv nor a relative. What do you think? Neither an Adam Chashuv nor a relative. Would that be okay? That's your typical lawyer. Your typical lawyer is representing a client who is not their relative, and your typical lawyer is usually not an Adam Chashuv, right? I mean, sometimes they might think of themselves as an Adam Chashuv, but for purposes of this discussion, Adam Chashuv means like a very distinguished Rav. It does happen from time to time. You do have distinguished Rabbanim who sometimes, you know, also are attorneys, but as a general rule, a lawyer will generally not be either. So are they allowed to serve in that capacity or not, to be a legal advisor, to give this type of legal advice?
With the bar and someone's considered an officer of the court, does that, in our culture, create the status of a relative, because you may be obligated to defend people?
Generally, let's work with the assumption to begin with that in the so-called tisalim is a very specific idea. That means that your one has a mitzvah to help out a relative, but that it has to be a real life relative. It has to be a real relative in order to qualify for the pasuk. So he quotes the Bach here, and he says from the Bach says Shaminim de me ain adam chashiv ain isolarach with nandayan raayas the zakos kirovo. Says we see from these sugyas in the Gemara that if someone's not an adam chashiv, then there's no prohibition to help out a relative. But the Bach says only a relative. He quotes the Tosas Yantiv. It says the Nivlo Kesheino Adam Chashuv Apilu Shlokul Klovo Shari. Tosas Yantiv says I think that if it's not an Adam Chashuv, even if it's not a relative, it will be permitted. But that's very, very difficult because the Gemara indicates that only because of the fact that Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman were relatives did they have a Havamina, even before taking into account the Adam Chashuv consideration. Only then did they have a Havamina that it would be permissible. So it's Mashma. It appears that even if somebody is not an Adam Chashuv, if they're not a relative, it still would be problematic to give this type of legal advice. And the Piskei Tshuva comes out really in favor, or seems to be tilting in that direction, that if you look at Rashi, it also appears that Me'eno Krovo Lo Shari, that if we're dealing with somebody who's not a relative, that this would not be permitted under any circumstances. So the So from this discussion, it would appear that even before we get to the question of litigating in front of the Beis Din, even serving as a legal advisor could be problematic, except that there's one Gemara that indicates otherwise. So the lawyers can breathe a little sigh of relief. Maybe there is some hope for the lawyers yet, because in Source Fest, we have another Gemara in also Maseches Kesuvos that talks about Rabbi Yochanan giving advice to a relative. Only in this Gemara, we don't find that Rabbi Yochanan had any regrets. In this case, there was, once again, a second marriage. Frivei de Rabbi Yochanan Avalu Isas Abba, a relative of Rabbi Yochanan, had his father was married to a woman who had a very hearty appetite, and she was eating the father and the family out of house and home. Tarakim of Sada Mizoni, she was just had a need for so much food that she was just depleting all the assets of the estate with these giant meals. So Asla Kamei de Rabbi Yochanan, so this relative said, I'm not going to have anything left to my inheritance because this woman is eating everything up. So Amalahu, Izilu Amalei Lavucham, apparently the father was on his deathbed, the way the Mephoreshim understand. Father was on his deathbed, so Rabbi Yochanan advised that this person say to the father who was on his deathbed that before he died, the Niyachin La'ara the Mizona, that he only set aside one parcel of land. That will be the parcel of land that can be tapped by the wife who is soon to become widow in terms of eating her mizonos. But once the value of that parcel of land would be exhausted, then she wouldn't be allowed to have mizonos from the rest of the estate. And this way she would not exhaust all of the assets of the estate. And the Gemara does not indicate that he slapped himself on the head and said, oy, 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 asino atzmeno ke'alkei ke'alkei adayanim. So Tosfos asked this question. Tosfos right there says, afagat le'el niskarit Rabbi Yochanan mashi isin eitzo. Even though in the previous case regarding the refuah, Rabbi Yochanan had regrets over the fact that he gave advice. Haka ein genai. Here there is no problem, there's no disgrace, there is no issue. Why? Kiven debidaita taloyim tirtza lekabel. Says Tosos, because this case is different from the other case. How is this case different from the other case, or for that matter, from the other cases? Because the decision was ultimately up to this woman, up to this wife, whether she wanted to accept this designation of one parcel of land as the collateral or as the source for the income that she would need for her mizonas, for her sustenance. And she could have said, no, I don't want to restrict it to one parcel of land. So therefore, she had equal bargaining power. So the implication is that if one party has equal bargaining power, that's a totally different ballpark. When is it that we say that there are various restrictions and that when a person's an Adam Chashuv, they shouldn't do it even though they're a relative, or maybe even if somebody is not a relative, they shouldn't get involved despite the fact that they're not an Adam Chashuv? When you're dealing with a situation of giving somebody an unfair advantage based on legal advice over another party, with that party doesn't have equal bargaining power, where in the case of the refuah is a very, very sick lady, and she's doesn't have the ability to advocate for herself. Once a doctor is going to quantify the amount of the medical treatment, that's all that she's ever going to be able to receive. Or the daughter who just decides that she's going to forgive her mother's ksuva, where there's absolutely nothing that the purchaser is able to do about it. But over here, the choice is which is simply going to be presented to the other side. It's good legal advice, but the other side has the ability to consult with her attorney and to decide, yes, I agree to designate a parcel of land, or I don't agree to designate a parcel of land. So therefore, Tosfos indicates that when there is equal bargaining power, that's a different story. Then we're not going to disfavor lawyering in such a case. The Me'iri puts it a little bit differently. The Me'iri says, here there's a mitzvah component. The Me'iri says that this case is different from the case of when Rabbi Yochanan said, Asinu atzmeno ke'orkei hadayanim, because here, because here he wasn't the person, the relative in question was not looking to take away from somebody what they otherwise deserved, like in the case of the wife who needed to pay for her medical bills. But here, El Lishama Slotavsi Lisiyasomim, here it was in order to prevent this woman from causing loss to the orphans, to the children, that they would lose all of their estate for reasons that were not justifiable because she was eating too much. That case is a totally different story because there Rabbi Yochanan was advising the relative in such a way that the relative would not take care of a person's medical needs, which is a much more morally dubious exercise. And the Yamshel Shlomo, the Maharshal, says it very similarly. This is source Yud Aleph. He says that Shahaisa Mabe Le'echo Yotem Minashir. What's the case that we're talking about, where this woman was eating way too much, and it wasn't fair for the Yisomim? Abahu Adin, he says, and so too we can extrapolate from here to any type of case of legal advice that Kol Heicha Da'asi Hefse La'Adam Miish Acher Ayidei Shinoi Mikra V'Doma L'Pshia, that whenever one person is causing loss to somebody else through a negligence or improper conduct, that it is appropriate to serve as a lawyer in that context in order to fulfill the mandate of lahatzil ashuk miyad oshko. In other words, that the same way that there's a mitzvah of mibasar cholo tisalem, there's also a mitzvah lahatzil ashuk miyad oshko if the goal and objective of the attorney is to help somebody not be taken advantage of, to represent somebody who would otherwise be vulnerable and might end up being harmed without sound legal advice, not to gain an unfair advantage over somebody else who is a vulnerable and a party subject to exploitation, but to simply protect your own client from being taken advantage of. So that is something which is considered to be perfectly permissible. So now at least we have more of a framework of what's considered to be appropriate in terms of a lawyerly role from the standpoint of halakha, and what would generally not be considered to be appropriate, where there's either not equal bargaining power or where a lawyer is helping somebody do something which is ethically dubious, where the only time where you could, you know, potentially validate that type of behavior is if you're dealing with a relative who's not an adam chashuv, because somebody's a relative, so we understand it's almost as if they're the baal dava themselves. They're like the party themselves. So if it's not actually illegal, so a party can fend for himself or fend for herself, but it's not proper to assist somebody in that type of behavior unless there's a mitzvah element in assisting the individual. The Maharshal says that it has to be lahatzil ashuk miyad oshko, and Tosfos is even more lenient. Tosfos says even if there isn't a mitzvah element, but both parties simply have equal bargaining power. So this, yes.
The problem with this mikaras of our sarfa lo titalim,
yes,
and nevertheless it was a morally dubious case.
That's right.
Originally.
Since it was morally dubious, therefore he could not have gotten involved if not for the fact of that he was almost like a baldov himself because he was a member of the family. But then he concluded, Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman in his case, that it was still not appropriate because that Adam Chashuv Shiny, and an Adam Chashuv has to hold himself to a different standard, and also people are going to learn from him.
But you shouldn't have done it in the first place.
No,
anyway.
We don't say it's an actual prohibition. There was no sin that was being committed. It was just, you know, somewhat exploitative. But as long as a person's not doing something illegal and they're looking out for themselves, so that would not be something that would be usher, that would be absolutely forbidden for, let's say, for this relative herself to have thought of this, you know, clever idea, I'm going to quantify the medical treatment, or I'm going to, you know, forgive the loan. So since she could have done it herself, so a relative could also, you know, get involved because it's as if it affects, it's as if the relative is an extension of the party, if not for the Adam Chashuv consideration. But if we weren't dealing with a relative, then we're saying it's not something that would be appropriate to do. So if you thought of it in that context, and you thought about what attorneys do in general, so you think that, so it would come out that, like, the most lofty type of role that an attorney could play would be to, you know, represent somebody in a pro bono basis, where, you know, they're helping some person who otherwise doesn't have means of representation and otherwise might be a victim of the system or otherwise, you know, might not fully understand or appreciate their rights, and they're hoping that individual be able to not be taken advantage of, not be exploited, not be harmed by others, and to have the full knowledge and to have the full benefit of the legal system to ensure that they be able to conduct their affairs in a fashion which is fair-minded to themselves. And that would be presumably even in the realm of a potential mitzvah. But it would seem from here that if somebody was functioning as an attorney, and again, I'm focusing in a Beis Din context, but they're advising somebody in a way in which they're going to maximize their financial advantage over a more, you know, vulnerable, less sophisticated party, using their legal know-how and using their mastery of halakha, as the case may be, so that's something that would be disfavored. Now, I should mention, there is the sheet of the Gidulei Truma. The Gidulei Truma was an early Achron, was of the opinion that if the lawyer, the Orech Din, the person functioning in this capacity, is getting paid by the party who hires them, so the Gidulei Truma thought that might be even better on some level, because if they're getting paid, so that makes them already, that gives them a stake in the outcome of the case, since they're getting paid for their services. They're getting paid for their services, so he thought maybe that converts them into a relative on some level. Now, the, right, so this is sort of like, you know, the opposite of saying that, you know, the ideal circumstances when you're helping somebody pro bono. He's like, no, the ideal circumstances is getting paid. What? Yes, but he wants to do a good job, obviously, so he'll be hired again and get paid. And get paid again, so it doesn't only have to be, you know, that he gets a contingency fee. So the objection or the, you know, potential critique of that approach is that Mibisacha lo tisalim is an objective mitzvah. Lahatzel ashik miyat oshko is an objective mitzvah. I mean, making a parnasa is an important thing, but it doesn't say that you can, should make a parnasa in any which way. So there's no objective mitzvah per se in taking money in order to give somebody legal advice. So therefore, it's not entirely obvious that the analogy to Mibisacha lo tisalim is completely apt just by virtue of the fact that person gets paid money. Unless you say that you view your lawyer like a member of your family, you know, because the lawyer becomes like a family attorney and they get close and they get invited to all the simchos and, you know, and all that, but I don't think it's exactly the same thing as saying that there is a prima facie mitzvah obligation when we saw chalot to sally.
Sometimes they become ambassadors.
Sometimes, yes, yes, that's correct. Okay, so now let's move on to the second half of the equation, which is serving in a litigation capacity. Okay, this up to now we've been talking about serving in an advisory capacity. So very interestingly, there isn't too much in the Gemara about the notion of even being able to hire somebody or to delegate somebody to serve as your representative in a Beis Din proceeding. The only sugya that really seems to touch upon this is the sugya of harsha'a, the sugya of a power of attorney, where the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Ayin, talks about the possibility of assigning somebody to be your power of attorney to prosecute a case on your behalf. Where, for example, there's a pikadon that you deposited somewhere out in Indonesia. And it's not so easy for you to get out to Indonesia, not the sort of thing, you know, not the sort of place where you would go every single day. So you're worried you're never going to be able to pick up your deposit because the person's never, you know, going to come to America to return it to you. But you have somebody in the community who is going out to Indonesia, and you give that person a power of attorney that they can go and pick up the deposit, and that if there is any dispute, because the person doesn't want to return it for whatever reason, so you say that if there is any kind of a claim that has to be made in front of the Beis Din of Indonesia, if there is such a thing, then I give you full authority that you will be able to stand in my place. But this is a very elaborate procedure. It's not so much like the retention of an attorney. It's more like when you're filling out a power of attorney form where you're giving somebody the ability to act like yourself in every respect, in every single fashion. It's a much, it's, it's a question as to whether it's an agency, whether you're making the person a partner in the entire endeavor. That's the discussion that is, that's gufa. That is exactly the nature of the discussion in the Gemara over there. But it's something which is very, very strong. And even the formulation of how such a person is appointed, this is discussed by the Nahardai and the Baba Kama Daf Ayin of an Aleph that says, Zil Dun Mizaki V'Afik L'Napshech, that it has to say, you have the ability to adjudicate this case and to take over the claim for yourself. Even if the eventual deal is that the person, after taking over the claim for themselves, will then give the proceeds to the person who originally empowered them, but it's something, it's a very, very formal assignment of responsibility, a very formal assignment of the actual physical claim that one person has in favor of the other person, and that's what the Gemara seems to allow in certain contexts. It only allows it in the context of the person who has the claim, appointing somebody to pick up the claim, and the reason for this is because otherwise there would be a loss that the person would simply never be able to recover their claim. So therefore we provide for this dispensation, what we call an orchasa amitaltali. And so the Gemara in Shavuos qualifies this a little bit. That source Yud Gimel, the Gemara there says, "Vasher lo tov asa b'soch amav." I think it's a pasuk in Yishayel. Says a person didn't do good within their nation. What is that referring to? This no goodnik. The no goodnik is v'avamar zehaba b'harshah. This is somebody who has become a morsha, who has been empowered to prosecute somebody else's claim. Says the Gemara, that's considered to be a very unethical, lousy thing. So even though it's permissible, the Gemara seems to frown even upon this type of a function. So Tosfos asks the question. Tosfos says, well, the Gemara in Baba Kama indicates that it is okay, so is it okay, is it not okay? So Tosfos says, again, it depends. Much like the legal counseling case, the representation case, for purposes of litigation, also depends on the circumstances, says Tosfos. So Tosfos says, when is it considered to be a bad, negative, frowned upon thing? If the pronounce is olam, this is only when it's being done because, question how to understand the Tosfos, one way the Tosfos is understood, I think by the Rama, is that who's the olam over here? The person who is appointed. We have a very strong individual. We have a very powerful, intimidating, forceful individual who is empowered by the one who has the claim to be the one to prosecute the claim. Uval Tanos, he's very good at arguing vociferously other people's claims. Shemis Aber Rivlo Lo, and that's not considered to be a good thing, because he is insinuating himself in somebody else's personal business. But if the purpose of the exercise is not to appoint a strong man, a strong-armed individual who is going to be a type of gangster, personality, who is going to prosecute the claim in an intimidating fashion, but rather the reason why he's being appointed is because otherwise it would just be a very, very difficult task to go all the way to a remote location to recover whatever the claim is. So then that's mitzvah kavi, that would be considered to be okay. And this, in fact, is the way that the Rama understands what the Tosfos is saying. You look in the Rama, in Hilchos Toshah, Siman Kof Kof Gimel, Sif Tes Vav, Mikol Shemishba, Tosfos says that, the Rama says, when is it that it's a problem to appoint somebody else to prosecute the claim on your behalf? Calls Manshe Amorsha, when the person who is being appointed is this incredibly intimidating individual, who Olam Uval Tanos, he's a very strong individual, a very imposing individual, who is very clever with his sophistry, and Miss Abir Ariv Lolo, and he insinuates himself in a matter where he is really just there to pursue his strong arm tactics, but it's not his claim that he is pursuing. But again, we find the same theme of the Maharshal with respect to being a legal advisor. If the prosecuting of the claim is really lahatzel ashik mioshko, because otherwise the claim is a very clear-cut claim, and the fear is that the one who has the claim will never be able to recover it otherwise, so then it's a mitzvah ka'avid. So we kind of have this tension. Is the lawyer somebody who's just going to really be, he's there because we want somebody who's very, very intimidating, but it's not as if the a person who has the claim couldn't otherwise bring it himself, but he figures it will be more powerful and more effective if I bring somebody who is a very good litigator, and that's why I'm hiring this person. That seems to be frowned upon. Or is it that otherwise there's no way in the world that the one who has a legitimate claim will be able to recover if he doesn't just appoint somebody, and not necessarily because of the person's excellent argumentation skills, but because the person is, you know, prepared to travel the long distance in order to, you know, act in his stead. How is he different from a shliach? It's a very similar concept to a shliach, truthfully. It's a very similar concept to a shliach, except that in order for the Maharsha to be effective, the Gemara says that the claim has to fully be assigned to him. Because if it's not fully assigned to him, the person who is being litigated against can make the claim. He can say, Lav bal dvarim didi at, that you are not my adversary. You are not the person I entered into the transaction with. I don't accept you as a shliach. So therefore, in order for the other party to have be required to accept this person as their adversary, the entire claim has to be almost sold on some level. It has to be gifted. It has to be assigned, given over fully to this individual. So this person becomes the Baal Din. They become the litigant entitled to all of the rights and the privileges that would pertain to the actual litigant in the case, the actual claimant in the case.
Is this the type of document they used on the Silk Road?
They were actual shtaris. Ada Yom Hazeh, they're actual shtaris called the Shtar Hasha. You look in the Nachla Shiva, you look in the official contract form book, you know, of Halacha, which is called the Nachla Shiva. It was compiled about 300 and so years ago. So you'll find these types of shtaris. You'll find these types of, when I was at the Beis Din of America in New York, and I would open up these old file cabinets from the 1960s, so I found a whole folder, Shtari Hasha. They had these very long stories of Hasha. They had all these fancy language, you know, these fancy terms and phrases straight out of the Gemara and the Rishonim of, I am hereby transferring to you all of the rights and the privileges to my claim. It was in Hebrew, Aramaic, and so forth, you know, but that I am giving to you an actual acquisition of my claim so that you can represent me in Beis Din. So there, so in order to do that, says Tosus and the Rama, it depends upon whether it's being assigned to somebody because that person is a very effective and intimidating litigator. That wouldn't be right. Or whether it's being assigned to them because that person just has more of the wherewithal to, you know, travel the necessary distances in order to prosecute the claim against the other party. So if you look in the Shach in Tezayin, so the Shach first has a quibble with respect to the Ramah, the definition of what Morsha means, of who the Olam is. He says, is the Olam the Morsha? Is the Olam the attorney? So the Ramah says that the Morsha, that the one who's the Olam, who is the imposing figure, is the one who's appointed as the Morsha, who is going to be prosecuting the claim. And the Shach doesn't like that so much. He says that if the Morsha is going to be arguing correctly, and there is a valid claim, so who cares that he happens to have a smooth tongue and that he happens to be an effective litigator? And if he's going to be a liar, so nobody's allowed to lie, not somebody who's very intimidating and not somebody who is, you know, as sweet as sugar. Nobody is allowed to lie. So what difference does it make if he happens to be a particularly intimidating person? But then he says at the end, no, maybe it does make a slight difference in the following sense. He quotes from a Kesef Mishnah. And he says like this, near at three lines in the bottom of the Shach in the source test, I am near the cover. And also, you might say that makes a difference like this. That he knows that we're talking about a Loveh who is going, who is himself a very difficult individual. The one who owes the money, say it's a borrower and they're collecting a loan. The one who owes the money is himself a very difficult individual. However, we're dealing with a case where he is not going to, he might make himself very difficult if the original claimant would prosecute the claim, but he's not going to be as difficult with respect to the representative. Why is that? Kigon, Shamorsha, who Adam Chashuv, where the Morsha himself is a very distinguished personality and nobody's going to make trouble against him. You appoint a representative who is a very distinguished standing. Or the Morsha is somebody who's just more clever. In other words, he might be a very skilled litigator, but he's going to use his litigation skills not to oppress somebody who otherwise, you know, maybe didn't really owe the money or might have had good counterclaims, but he's going to use his skills in order to prevent this person who's a very difficult person, namely the defendant, from finagling his way out of his obligation. So once again, there is an understanding that if the litigator, even if he is using his litigation skills, but he's using his litigation skills in a way in which he's simply preventing an injustice from being committed against the claimant, so that would be considered to be legitimate. So the Chazonish, this is source Yud Zayin over here,
leveling the playing field.
Once again, it's leveling the playing field and making sure again that we have equal bargaining power. If we want to go back to what the Tosfos said in Maseches Ksuvos. Now, Chazonish, yes.
Does the Marisha have to make a determination that his party is in fact the righteous one?
That's an interesting question. What responsibility devolves upon the Morsha? So we haven't really discussed that so much, except that the Gemara in Maseches Shavuos indicates that yes, because the Gemara says Asher lo tov asav esochamav zeh haba be'ershah. This is somebody who allows himself to be a Morsha. So it sounds like there is a certain ethical responsibility upon the Morsha to make sure that they are really helping somebody level the playing field, so to speak, or do a real mitzvah, as opposed to somebody who's being utilized in order to perpetrate an injustice. So if you look in source Yud Zayin, the Chazonish says, the Yeshama, going back to Tosfos, the Kavanas Tosfos, what is Tosfos getting at? When the Tosfos was focusing on the tough personality of the Morsha, indicating that that might be a problem if the Morsha is an Olam Ubal Tainos, who's getting involved in a matter that doesn't affect him. The Kavanas Tosfos, the Baal Tainos, Yochel Ahatrit Esa Bezdin, Esa Balidin. The problem with the Morsha is, who happens to be a very tough, imposing individual, is that this type of individual, through his slick tongue and through his intimidating presence, might end up causing a travesty of the Beis Din proceedings, and might end up causing the other party to become discombobulated and frazzled in their own presentation, thus leading to an unjust result. That because this person is such a clever arguer, this person might create all kinds of doubts in connection with the Beis Din proceeding, and that now we're getting to the actual nitty-gritty of the Beis Din proceeding itself. If you have such an individual who is such a slick attorney, so to speak, then they might end up skewing the justice of the Beis Din proceeding by creating all kinds of smoke and mirrors and confusion for the Beis Din and for the other party. Ala Beis Din lefam shogeh baal din mitshuvaso, and sometimes such an individual will fluster the other party in terms of being able to answer correctly. Altano shekinegdo on the claims leveled against him, miskaya bedin, and the person who otherwise really should have prevailed in judgment will be found to be the guilty or the obligated party in judgment. Is there ain't a maklal sheker? It's true that this slick individual might not be committing any sheker, might not be saying anything which is an outright lie. When we come up, Nisar b'shelach tamim. But nonetheless, it's not proper for this person who's such a sharp lawyer to get involved in somebody else's case, because they might, through the sheer ability of their skills alone, skew the outcome of the case in a fashion which ends up being unjust. In other words, do what lawyers are supposed to do. Okay, but this is not something which, says the Chazon Ish, is necessarily favored by the halacha, and that's considered to be misaber arib lo lo. Okay, v'zkein nira kavanas Tosas, and this is what Tosas was condemning. Shein kan siba me'akeves amar. So we're talking about a case where really the original claimant could have brought the case himself. Shein yakal abo biatzul lebez. We're not talking about where he couldn't come himself to the bezdin. It's just he wants a razzle-dazzle, crack-a-jack attorney to represent him, who's going to cause the other party to stammer in their presentation, and they're going to therefore tilt the justice of the proceedings in front of the bezdin. So that's what we're talking about.
Where are the judges here? I mean, aren't they in control of what the...
That's what the Chazon Ish says. Well, yes, the judges are in control, but at the same time, if the this attorney is going to be so successful at causing the other party, in this case, to be completely flustered and to be easily razzled, then that will also impair the Bezdin's ability to be able to fully appreciate the case that would have otherwise been brought by the other party. Okay? We're going to get to that, though. What's the responsibility of Bezdin? It happens to be a very good question. What's the responsibility of Bezdin? However, even if Bezdin has a responsibility, we don't want to l'chatzkila create a situation where Bezdin will be at a disadvantage, that they will have to be doing damage control. Better not to have the damage in the first place that needs to be controlled. Yes, if we have the damage, the Bezdin should control it, but the point the Chazon Ish is making is we're trying to prevent that damage from even being part of the proceedings in the first place. So the one word that has not appeared up until now is the word lawyer. What we've had is this idea of morship, like power of attorney. But where is there any basis in all of Chazal for the notion of somebody who is simply appointed for the basic purpose of serving as just a lawyer? They're not serving as the person who has been assigned all of the claims. In the discussion of the Tosos, of the Shach, of the Chazon Ish, we already are beginning to recognize the foundations of such an individual. But is this a later creation? Does it appear anywhere in Chazal? It's one line in a Yerushalmi. And that line refers to a person called a mysterious individual known as Antler Man. Okay? Antler. This is a Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin in connection with a Kohen Gadol. It says a Kohen Gadol can be brought to a litigation, even though he's the Kohen Gadol. I mean, it's not really so fitting that you're going to take the Kohen Gadol out of the Beis HaMikdash. He's going to have to come to Bezdin to court. So the Gemara asks the question, but Yimanimli Antler, have him appoint an Antler. Why does he have to come himself and get appointed Antler? You know, let Mr. Antler come and represent him in Bezdin. And what's wrong with that? So the Gemara there answers no, because it could be he has to take a shvuah. For Antler b'shvuah, is the Antler going to be able to take an oath on his behalf? Obviously, only he can take an oath. But it appears that there is such a notion that's contemplated as called Antler. So there does seem to be a recognition that maybe sometimes people were doing this, just appointing individuals to argue on their behalf, even if they weren't technically a morsha. And that you have this tension in the later sources that talk about the reality of the practices that existed in the Bati Din from time immemorial. Time immemorial means starting like 12th century or stuff. There's actually like an official date when time immemorial began. And you find, even going back to time immemorial, in Bati Din proceedings, there were Tohanim Rabbanim. They weren't assigned the cases in terms of power of attorney. They were just arguing the cases on behalf of their litigants. So you find an interspersing of these terms, Morsha, and also Antler in later literature, because we had to find some sort of a halakhic term for something that, at least according to Talmud Bavli, doesn't appear to exist. Further complicated by source of your test, with Shulchan Aruch Paskins, a big discussion we showed him. Bottom line, Shulchan Aruch Paskins, that only a Tovea, somebody who needs to recover a claim,
claim, is allowed to appoint a power of attorney to whom he can assign a claim, but not the defendant. A defendant can't assign a claim because he doesn't have a claim. He just has a defense. We allow people in the Beis Din of the CRC, as well as the Beis Din of America, we allow people to bring counterclaims. If a plaintiff brings a claim against them, we say, you can bring counterclaims against the plaintiff. But in reality, they wouldn't have brought a claim, a counterclaim, if the plaintiff hadn't brought a claim against them. So generally speaking, they don't have any claim to assign. So since they don't have a tangible claim to assign, therefore the halakha is they're not allowed to appoint a marshal, which already creates the possibility for an imbalance that you could have a benefit proceeding where one party would be the claimant, will be entitled to a representative, but the NIPA will not be entitled to a representative. And there's another problem for a proceeding which is directly in front of the Beis Din, and the other problem for a proceeding which is directly in front of the Beis Din, we'll end with this and we'll continue next time, is that there's a halacha of al pi shnayim edim, that the Beis Din has to hear directly from witnesses, right? You can't hear, you can't have like a written testimony sent in. They have to hear from the witnesses, below al pi haMetorgamin and not through a translator. Well, the Gemara seems to indicate, this based on a Gemara in Maseches Makos, as understood by the Rambam, this isn't only true with respect to the witnesses, but it's true with respect to the parties themselves. A Beis Din has an obligation in order to discern the truth, in order to look at the way the parties are presenting their cases, the way their mouths move, the way that they present their facial expressions, their body language, in order to ascertain the truth. A Beis Din needs to look at the parties themselves, and therefore, that's why we say that they have to appear below al pi haMetorgamin and not a translator. Well, that very same principle that says below al pi haMetorgamin also translates to the conclusion that even when there might be some sort of a mechanism for appointing somebody else, Beis Din really needs to hear from the parties themselves based on this principle that they're not going to be able to get at the truth if they're not able to speak to parties themselves. A Morsha, I understand, because a Morsha has been assigned the rights to the case, so they become the actual litigant. But if you don't actually assign the rights to the case and you're talking about like an attorney, so then you have a chisaron, then you have a lack of this requirement of mipihem or al pi shnayim edim below al pi haMetorgamin, that it has to, you have to be able to hear from the Baalei Din themselves and not through a third party who is going to distill their claims without the ability of the Beis Din to, you know, look at the body language of the parties themselves and the way that they present the claims. So next time, we're not going to meet next week. We'll meet 2 weeks from today. We'll conclude this discussion and figure out what, if anything, is the justification then for allowing attorneys or tanim rabbanim to present cases on behalf of parties in Beis Din proceedings nowadays.
Okay. An antler. Stop there. Kohen Gadol has to show up then. Uh-huh. Then the Kohen Gadol will have to show up.
Right, right. Well, the Gemara, in fact, dismissed the idea of the antler in connection with Kohen Gadol. So, say, no, we can't point to an antler.
Why don't you consider Orfei Din to be some sort of